Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, I'm Steph and this is the Don't Buy Her Flowers podcast, and today, I'm getting straight to it, we are talking about sex. Specifically, I'm talking with Dr. Karen Gurney, aka the Sex Doctor, about sex in long-term relationships. Now look, I don't know how much sex everyone else is having, but I do know that when I get to go with my friends, possibly after we've partaken in some wine, the conversation will turn to sex and generally people are a bit less bothered than we used to be, but there's always someone who'll say, oh, I always enjoy it once I'm doing it. I always think we should do this more often. But they don't. And why don't we want to do it more, I guess, is one of the big questions. Dr. Karen explains that female desire is nothing like the spontaneous desire that we see in the movies. In fact, she says it is normal to never feel like sex out of the blue ever in a long-term relationship. And she's on a mission to explain how desire works and the consequences of it are quite staggering when you think about the impact that this and sex has on relationships. So we talk about that. We talk about the mental load. We talk about the impact that having children has on our sex lives, about feeling awkward with your partner when you haven't done it for ages, and how to get back to it. She has some really simple tips, and she puts it in a really succinct way, so I just think she's brilliant. We also talk about our inability to talk about sex, although I seem to have loosened up in this episode, so I apologise to Doug and all our family members who possibly don't want to hear me talking about our sex life, but hey. She also answers some listener questions at the end, where you will hear a small amount of drilling. It's not a lot, but just to let you know, just ignore that. And I could make a gag about sex and drilling, but I'm not going to. This episode is sponsored by sexual happiness company Love Honey, who are the UK's most popular online shop for buying adult toys and lingerie discreetly. So a massive thank you to them for supporting this episode. And I'm grateful to anyone for any support of the podcast. Please share the episode if you enjoy it, rate and review. And honestly, I don't want to over egg the pudding, so to speak. But I think this conversation could just revolutionise your sex life. Oh, it's so nice to see you.
And you.
I was thinking, so when we met, it was at Helen Thorne's book launch.
It was.
And I think it was Nat Lee said,
yeah.
Oh, this is Karen, you know, the sex doctor. And I, for some reason, I wasn't following you. And I was like, the sex doctor? What?
I love that, for some reason.
I know. Well, because all of that lot of friends of mine, and they all were like, That's true. Do you not know? But I then, without knowing any of your background, apart from that it was sex, apart from knowing any of your specialism, immediately, I think probably within about 30 seconds, said, I'm just not interested in sex. And you were like, well, you've come to the right place, because your specialist subject is all around female desire, right?
It is. I mean, I love all of it. I love anything to do with sex and sex research, but I'm so, so interested in desire.
The title of your TEDx talk was The Surprising Truth About Desire and How to Future-Proof Your Sex Life. And also, you've kind of said it's a bit of a mission of yours to get this out, because I have to say, like, having read your book, listened to the podcast and all that, and obviously watched the TED Talk, it's really simple concept about desire that you explain that is completely missing from my vocabulary around sex, but also I would say everybody I know. I've since, like, obviously researching and stuff, I've then chatting to people going, did you know this? Because every one of them I know, every woman I know, is kind of beating herself up that she's absolutely just not interested in sex. So go on, hit me with your mission about desire.
So just to kind of go back to what you were saying, it is absolutely the case that I don't think there's any area of our sex lives where there is such a gross misconception about how something should work other than desire. And the irony is that concerns about desire are the number one reason why people come and see someone like me for sex therapy. Mm-hmm. And also we know that a third of women in the UK are concerned that they don't have enough desire. So we're talking a really big problem in people's minds, something that people are constantly seeking help for, but yet nobody really knows how it should work, how it does work, how to make changes to it, how to get it featuring as much as you like. And I was just, my mind is blown by this, because I am there seeing couple after couple in sex therapy, can't handle the demand for people worrying about the fact that they're not as interested in sex. But it just so happens that women in relationships with men tend to have lower sexual satisfaction than women having sex with other women, for example. So women having sex with other women have the same issues around desire that we're about to talk about in a second, but they also have the advantage of having a bit less predictability, a bit more variety, and possibly a partner who's not necessarily experiencing things very differently than them. So I see plenty of women who have sex with women also about concerns about desire. It's definitely not a straight women's problem, but sexual satisfaction in long-term relationships is definitely something that affects women having sex with men more.
Right.
So the book is for women of all sexualities, but I'm really passionate about the fact that there are simple things that everyone could do with knowing that people just don't know about how desire works, about what extinguishes it, what fans the flames of it. And they're often not the things that people think. And that's why I wrote the book, and that's why I did the TED Talk, and why I love talking about it.
The biggest thing that you say is that our learning about desire and what we see all the time in every film, movie, TV show, everything is about this spontaneous sex that is the shirt ripping passion, the up against the fridge, all that stuff. And you basically say that that is not happening anywhere.
Yeah, so let's dive into it, because perhaps that will help put some meat on the bones of it as well. So yeah, we know that when we have a new sexual partner, we tend to experience higher levels of spontaneous desire.
Yeah.
And that isn't exactly out of the blue, because there are plenty of things going on which put desire at the forefront of our minds. So for example, lots of flirting, lots of touching, lots of eye gazing, lots of kind of intense emotional intimacy, lots of date nights that are just about the two of you kind of forgetting the world, lots of physical touch. So at the beginning of a relationship, we know that spontaneous desire for people of all genders is fairly high. So people think about sex, and they have lots and lots of triggers to make them think about sex. So you get a text from that person. You're looking forward to a date that evening, and you're thinking, oh, we might have sex tonight. And in your mind, you're mentally preparing for that sex. Does that make sense?
And it's so exciting, that bit.
It's so exciting. And it's important to think about what that person represents in your mind at the start of a relationship. So anyone that's listening who's in a long-term relationship will be able to really connect with this. This is the version of them that doesn't not put the bins out. This is the version of them that doesn't like put their toenail clippings on the sofa. This is a version of them which is always at their best, which is always engaging, which is listening to you intently, which is being romantic, which is being spontaneous, who you've not yet seen the kind of annoying sides of yet. These are all of the reasons why at the start of a relationship, spontaneous desire is high, high for people of all genders. What then happens is that about a year and a half in, we can't be too specific, but we know things change around that time. There tends to be a big drop in spontaneous desire. This happens again for people of all genders, but we know that it's easier for men to hold on to more spontaneous desire. And perhaps we'll talk about why later on. So we know that for women particularly, experiencing a drop in spontaneous desire, and I can't stress this enough, is completely normal in a long-term relationship. What that means is it's normal to never feel like sex out of the blue ever in a long-term relationship. It's not a sexual problem. It's not a problem with your desire. It's how desire functions after you've been with someone a period of time. It's really common for women to feel that they're broken, and also I've seen plenty of women who've drawn parallels with this and said, well, it must be me, because this hasn't happened in every long-term relationship that I've been in. Mm-hmm. I felt like sex at the beginning, and then I'm just not interested. And I'm like, well, the pattern is the long-term relationship, not necessarily anything. As much as we all try and conform to monogamy, it's not really that well suited to humans in terms of our sexual interests. So there are plenty of reasons why that happens. It's super important because, of course, there's variety between women, and we have plenty of women who do experience higher levels of spontaneous desire and continue to in a long-term relationship. But there was a large-scale piece of research which showed us that actually a significant majority of women, when asked how often do you feel like sex out of the blue, said either never or very, very rarely. And sometimes that's connected to menstrual cycles as well for people not on hormonal contraception. So sometimes people were noticing maybe once a month, maybe around ovulation, or just when their period started, they might notice feeling a bit of spontaneous desire. So this is important because what generally happens when people aren't experiencing spontaneous desire is they think, what's this about? What's wrong with me? I've lost my libido. What's wrong with our relationship? I no longer want to have sex with them. And I don't know why, because I love them and it's a good relationship and there isn't any reasons why. I just don't feel like it. And once that happens, people then start responding to their partner in a slightly different way. So if their partner perhaps, you know, comes up to them and gives them a bit of a kiss, their brain goes into alarm mode, like what are they after? Because I'm not feeling like sex. So I'll close this down before it goes anywhere.
You had, I think it was an example where you talked about this like hypervigilance. So if they're coming on to you, there was a couple who she would jump in the shower on a Saturday morning because Saturday morning is when he tended to try it on or they were going to have sex. And she'd jump in the shower before he got the chance to touch her because she panicked that she doesn't want to have sex, or she thinks I'm not in the right mood, so I need to get out of that really quickly. And I just really recognize that as something that, because you're not in the mood, if they are then a bit touchy or whatever, you're kind of like, oh, well, I don't want to lead them on. I don't want to give the wrong impression, because as soon as I touch them back, that then they think we're going to have sex. And then I can't do that, or I'm not in the right mood, or I'm tired or whatever else. And again, I think that's something that loads of people would recognize.
Lots of people. And so lots of people say to me, I go to bed at a different time. I make sure I wear certain things to bed, which give a signal that it's not going there. And what we start to see then is a reduction in what I call sexual currency. So we start to have less physical affection, less sexual intimacy, less flirting, less kissing, less of all of the things that we kind of need to trigger desire. So that brings us on to, well, if it's normal for people to not feel desire out of the blue in a long-term relationship very often, then that's depressing, isn't it? You know, what are we all doing? And maybe we should just all have open relationships or not get married or not settle down at all. And of course, that works for plenty of people. But the thing is that when we measure a different type of desire, when we measure desire which responds to triggers, so what I mean by that is, if you think about watching a good sex scene on TV, does watching that sex scene make you feel a little bit turned on, you know, make you think about sex, make you feel a bit more open to the idea of sex? When we measure that type of desire, which is called responsive or triggered desire, we find that women's desire works perfectly fine. So under those conditions, with something to trigger it, all of those women who are worried about their desire actually have no problem with desire. So the problem isn't their desire. Their problem is that there aren't enough situations. There isn't enough stimuli, if you like, to trigger it. And that, of course, is made worse when you're avoiding your partner's touch, when you're avoiding a kiss, when you're avoiding them saying you look hot today, because you're thinking, oh, I know what they mean by that.
And because you think that desire is meant to be spontaneous and you're not feeling spontaneously desireful, so then it's shutting it down. So, but it, so yes, taking it right back to your whole concept really messes with the whole pattern of trying to have sex.
Yeah, because what you actually need is the opposite. Mm. What you need is all of the stuff we talked about that we have at the beginning of the relationship, which of course we can't maintain at that level, and we wouldn't want to because we'd be...
that couple.
intolerable, yeah. But, you know, if people kind of think about their relationship right now, anyone that's listening who's in a regular relationship, and you think, well, how often actually do we really like connect with each other, have a bit of a laugh together, really listen and feel quite intimate emotionally? Or how much of the day are we actually just operating side by side, mm. getting stuff done and not really even making eye contact mm. and just going through the motions? How much do we passionately kiss, you know, for a couple of seconds at a time when it's not part of sex? Mm. That's something that falls off the agenda for a lot of couples quite early on. Kissing becomes a signal, a passionate kiss, instead of being a passionate kiss that's got no pressure attached to it, like it was at the beginning, that could trigger desire, becomes a signal that someone wants sex, someone's initiating sex, and that feels like it's pressure, and we go, oh, no, this is not the thing I want. Yeah. So passionate kissing, like that emotional intimacy, the flirting, the all of that stuff, which I call sexual currency, it's that we need more of. Mm. That's the kind of stuff that really fans the flames of desire.
Well, and just having read the book, and I was talking to Doug about it, and we're trying to make an effort. This is not like my parents and my kids don't want to know about this, but we're trying to make an effort because you find yourself giving a peck on the cheek like a mum does to their child, and it slips into that. And like, we've been married for, I think, nearly 15 years. So it's the peck on the cheek, or even just the right, see you later, as they go out the door. There's no interaction at all, which my young self of us that when we met would be horrified by to see that. So you have to almost do it in order to then want to do it more.
Yeah, so a culture change is needed for a lot of us. And what's great is that culture changes can always happen, even if we've been in a routine of doing things differently for some time. And that's partly why I'm so passionate about this topic, because actually once you understand how desire works, you then have the option to go, actually, there are plenty of things, very small things that we can do that will shift this culture and will make desire something which features much more often in our sex life. And do we want to do that, or actually do we not? And we're just happy enough to know we're not broken, and we'll just keep going as we are.
Why is sex? Because you talk about sex being important in long-term relationships. And I think probably there could be couples who've been together to go, well, it's not that important anymore. It doesn't matter. But you do explain why it is important.
Obviously, there are plenty of people, and there are people who are quite happy not to have sex as part of their relationship. Mm-hmm. And there are also people who are asexual who are quite happy to either not have sex or not have much sex with another person. But for the majority of people, sexual satisfaction is important for long-term relationship satisfaction. So it only works one directionally, this. So relationship satisfaction doesn't mean you're going to have good sexual satisfaction. Mm-hmm. So I see a ton of couples for therapy who have brilliant relationships but aren't that happy with their sex life. So it doesn't work that way, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. You can have great relationship satisfaction not affecting sexual satisfaction at all. But the other way around, it really does work. So when sexual satisfaction is high, it tends to bring with it great relationship satisfaction. So we know that sexual satisfaction is really good for relationships. It helps to keep relationships good over time. It helps to meet people's kind of psychological needs of kind of feeling good about themselves. We know it protects around things like low self-esteem for people. We know that it protects against infidelity if people are in monogamous relationships. There's much more chance of monogamy working if people are feeling sexually satisfied. It's really quite important. And I see couples in my work at lots of different phases of their relationship lives, you know, everything from being together a few months to many decades. And you can see sometimes where that gradual erosion of relationship satisfaction has happened over time as a result of a sex life that's fallen off track.
Well, because I suppose because we make that association with actually the spontaneity bit, but even putting that to one side, if you make the association with sex being the mark of a good relationship, you do start to fall into that kind of housemates feeling, which doesn't feel good. Like, especially when, you know, if we're talking about lots of people who are in this rush hour, we're not old. We've got quite a way to go hopefully. So, so you kind of, it's a quite depressing thought just to go, oh, well, it's just become platonic. And especially because the comparison that you have is with that early bit where you're like, we did have it. We, you know, we know we can. And the other thing is that I wanted to mention is that a lot of people will, once they're doing it and once they've just done it, will say, oh, it was brilliant, we should do this more often. And you've said that you hear that so much, because then that's what, the sitting around with my girlfriends, that is, that's the line that we all will say, that we are like, oh, we should do this more, but then we're tired, or we don't, because we're waiting for that desire to spontaneously
waiting for desire which doesn't come. And that's a perfect indication of responsive desire. At the beginning you are perhaps quite ambivalent about it, but actually desire kicks in somewhere in the process, and afterwards you're like, oh my god, that's really good, why don't we spend more time doing that? And the responsive desire aspect of it, if more people knew about that, I wonder whether they might decide to run their sex lives, run their relationships slightly differently. Because if people think about what sex brings for them and the meaning of sex in their lives and how they feel about themselves or the relationships when sex is good, when it goes well, there's actually not much like it for kind of feeling alive, feeling connected to someone, feeling kind of secure in a relationship, feeling desired. Feeling as though there's something that marks the two of you out as a couple, which isn't about your roles as parents or your roles as housemates. And those types of benefits for the relationship can be quite big.
Yeah. And I mean, on to having children and what they do for your sex life. I think you gave a stat that people with kids under five have the lowest level of sexual satisfaction. I mean, it's not a surprise.
It's not a shocker, is it?
No, but it, again, you can't, because quite often that might be quite early into your relationship if you've had children relatively soon. So again, you're kind of thinking, bloody hell, is this it? Is it only downhill from now?
Yes. Yeah. So the kids thing is a big one, because I suppose this comes, if we just kind of go back to that idea of what desire is and what it isn't for a second. One of the things I didn't mention earlier was that we've been sold a bit of an idea that desire is a drive that's always within us, a libido. You know, it's either I've lost my libido or they've got high sex drive. People talk about it as though it's something which is just innate and present and there for us, regardless of what's happening in our lives. And actually, desire isn't like that. Desire is something psychological, where we are motivated to do something if we perceive that thing as being really rewarding. Okay, so if we think the sex we're going to have is going to be great and there aren't other competing priorities, then we might be motivated to do it. And this is where the kids stuff comes in, because actually what happens when we have kids, especially if we've got kids at home under five, is that we have so many other competing priorities. And because desire isn't an innate drive that's either there or isn't, because women are experiencing lower levels of spontaneous desire, then it stands to good reason that it would fall quite low down the priority list for many of us, because, you know, there's packed lunches to make and World Book Day outfits to think of. And let's not even get into the fact that women are carrying more of that kind of household admin burden.
There's a line in your book, actually, which I've underlined, the connection of mental load and sex. Can I read it to you? Is that all
right? Yes, please do.
So you've just said, studies have found that the more equitable the division of household tasks in relationships, the greater relationship and sexual satisfaction the couple usually report. Sadly, even in 2020, unequal gender politics translate to women in relationships, with men carrying out the lion's share of the emotional and practical burden of the household tasks. That's so massive, because again, you're sitting there thinking, well, I've got no libido, I'm not that interested. But also then the distraction of the volume of stuff you've got to do and the resentment that might make you feel. And he's all right, he's there horny because he's doesn't have this level of stuff that you've got going on in your head.
Yeah.
That's huge, I think.
It's huge. And, you know, as I mentioned there in the book, that's the reason why couples with a more equal division of labor have better sex, is because it is such a distraction having those competing priorities. And so if we think about starting from a position of no spontaneous desire, but being open to the idea of sex. Okay, so we start from that position that we're not feeling it at this point, but we're feeling open to it. What then happens is there's a bit of a what we call a sexual stimuli. So say the passionate kiss comes in, and we start kissing, and that is a thing that will turn our bodies and our brains over into desire mode because it's a sexual stimuli and our bodies respond to that. It's kind of the old-fashioned part of our brain that we share with other animals. But what's also going on is that the thinking part of our brain is competing for attention with the sexual stimuli. So the kiss is ongoing, but our brain starts going, what else is there to do tonight?
I've got loads of stuff to do.
How many hours sleep am I going to get?
This could be 20 minutes where I could be sleeping.
Exactly. And so the higher the mental load in terms of those other competing priorities, the less likely it is that our desire will be triggered by that kiss. So sometimes the work that I'm doing with couples is helping them think about if one of them is always initiating sex when it's like last thing at night and they're both completely knackered and there's like hardly any time to get sleep and they've got little kids who are going to wake up in the night probably anyway and they've got things on their mind for tomorrow, it's not really a great time. And sometimes the work I do with couples is helping them think about, actually, if you're going to prioritize time that might trigger desire, which is absolutely the best way of doing it, if you want sex to feature, you've got to make time to stoke that fire, if you like, with no pressure for it to go anywhere. And that's the sexual currency that we've talked about. If you're going to do that, then don't do it at a time like that when everyone's tired, or don't do it like after a meal when you're feeling really full and your brain's going, oh, my belly's massive and I feel like I'm going to burst. Yeah. You know, these aren't the best times. So that's why it's harder for people with young kids, because actually time is limited.
It's such a shock as well, isn't it? Because almost overnight you've got a baby and the load, especially probably on one of the couple, is bigger as the primary carer or whatever, and so it has a huge impact on the capacity you have for somebody else, which
huge
means
impact.
you're not going to have the headspace to even think about it. And almost it's more annoying if they're then being horny or whatever, because you're like, if you've got no idea, you're not relating to me at all in how I feel.
Yeah, it feels like you're being misunderstood. Yeah, and there's so much about that kind of journey to parenthood as well that's important here, because and I actually did one of my online workshops is about this, called How to Not Let Kids Ruin Your Sex Life. And it kind of tracks the whole process from even from trying to conceive and how things were in pregnancy, because actually for a lot of couples, the journey of trying to conceive or what happened to their sex life in pregnancy can also really send them on a path.
Yeah.
So it might not even be about the kid coming along. It can be the journey to that, which really affected their sex life. But then you've got that process of kind of, you know, the immediate bit postnatally, and something that women just often don't really know, which is about the impact of breastfeeding on desire. You know, the hormones that keep breastfeeding going, as I'm sure you know, really sap desire. And just having all of those physical changes to your body and the impact of birth and recovery from birth. But even post that, even kind of like 1 year plus, when hopefully people are getting a little bit of sleep, not everyone is, but most people are, just the journey that people have been on in parenthood, just the, as you say, the demands on people's time, just the increased mental load, the fatigue, all of those things really devastate people's sex lives, but they don't have to. And one of the things that I try and kind of get across in the workshop I've put together is you don't actually need to be having lots of sex to have a good sex life. Part of it is about understanding how desire works so that you can both feel relieved. Look, this isn't about us. It's not about our relationship. We're in the eye of the storm.
Yeah.
And let's just batten down the hatches and get through it so our sex life isn't too affected by it and we can get it back on track later on, type thing. Yeah.
Which is really reassuring in itself, because you always hear of a friend who managed to keep going the whole way through, and they, you know, or with somebody who doesn't feel affected by it, and you kind of think, well, I'm the only one that has been affected by this and all the changes that have gone in and stuff.
And it's much more common for people to struggle with their sex lives post kids, and we know that kind of once your kids are like, your youngest is a bit older than five, people start to have a little bit more capacity to think about that aspect of the relationship again. But where I come in then is saying, well, sometimes the trajectory has already been set by the years that have preceded that. And sometimes there's a bit of work that needs to happen to change that culture. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's what I try to do with the book and with my online workshops, is give people the tools to know how to change the culture, because people shouldn't need to come and see me for sex therapy. You know, some of these things are simple things that once you've learned about them, you can try and make small changes and see what difference it makes.
Well, that's how I feel. Having read the book, I feel like I've got a completely different understanding of sex and desire, to the point that I can then have that conversation with Doug, and he's like, I need to read that book, which, because that's the other thing.
That's great.
Do you get men to engage in this? Because I feel like it's something that women are more likely to engage in it, because also it makes us feel better as initially as like, oh God, it's not my problem as such. But I suppose you need for everyone to understand it, because otherwise...
Yeah, that's right. Anyone who has sex with women could do with reading it for that reason. And I get loads of messages from men, actually, loads of DMs saying, oh my God, thank you, because I didn't understand it. So I didn't know what to do. And now I understand it. I know that I was going about everything completely wrong. And just thinking about things like, well, when we talk about initiating sex, what do we actually mean? Mm. And not all initiation is created equal. And if your way of initiating sex is going, it's been ages, how about shag? It's not really a trigger for anyone's desire.
God, it's so probably so common.
It's so common. It's so common. And of course it works for some people because, you know, they've not got much on their mind and they're happy to go along with it, knowing their desire will follow. Mm. It's not bad for everyone, but often, you know, partners will say to me, and it's just to be clear as well, it's also sometimes the other way around. Sometimes the male partner who has lower levels of kind of spontaneous desire, and the female partner, if it's a straight couple, who has higher levels. So that's not unusual. We know about almost one in five men are concerned about their interest in sex in a long-term relationship. So I wouldn't want them to feel unusual. So the higher desire partner, you know, sometimes they are under the perception that, well, I'm initiating sex and they don't want it, so it's their problem. But let's really like break it down and look at, well, where is the mental load? Where is the time? How much is there kind of a sense of emotional intimacy and connection in other areas of your life? Mm. How much sexual currency is there? What does the initiation look like? And is it sexy? Mm. How rewarding is the sex that you're having? Or is one of you having more pleasure than the other? Mm. You know, there's all kinds of stuff to kind of look at and understand differently. And so, yes, I think the response that I tend to get about the book is women saying, it's like you've read my mind. And it's changed everything about how I see it, which is great. But for men, it's, I had no idea that I was going about everything in a way that was actually making it worse, not better. Mm. So I do think it's something that everyone needs to understand. And if you're someone who has higher levels of spontaneous desire, it's even more important that you understand it, because it's the other side of the coin. So your understanding is different. You feel like sex, you think about sex often, perhaps at this phase in your life. You might not in 10 years, but at the moment you do. Mm-hmm. So if your partner's experiencing it differently, then you kind of need to understand that if you want to navigate a good sex.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Life. And you talk about communication. I mean, I know it's obvious, but like you say, people are having to come to you. And what was interesting about what you said about getting people to communicate, once you sit them down and you kind of go through all this, you said it's usually a few sessions and they're sorted, which I don't think there's many therapies where that's the case. You know, I'm thinking if you're working on yourself, whatever, it could go on for years.
It frustrates me because, you know, this is the stuff that relationship breakups can sometimes be made from. A simple nugget of a sex life that starts to go down a trajectory that isn't great, doesn't get spoken about, doesn't get resolved. And then years later, you've got one or both people feeling really unsatisfied. Perhaps it leads to a breakdown of a relationship. Perhaps it leads to infidelity in a monogamous relationship. And it doesn't need to. Mm. And that's the bit I find frustrating, because there's so much that can be done. And I guess that's why I started my Instagram, because I thought, how do I get all of this stuff out to the masses?
Yeah.
Because this isn't a sex therapy issue. It's a societal issue in how we understand desire, and also how we understand how to run our sex lives, because we treat our sex lives as if they should just magically be great without any investment or effort because we love that person. Mm-hmm. And that just doesn't work for the majority of people. And we should treat our sex lives a bit like we treat our diet, mm-hmm. kind of with an awareness that if we pay it no effort and we don't really intentionally think about our choices, then over time we might not be as healthy as we might want to be.
But I think that's something, again, that I read and was like, oh my God, because if you had good sex with your partner, you expect for that to carry on without really doing anything about it. And that's exactly as you say, compared to nearly every other aspect of friendships, relationships, I don't know, work, you have to
exercise.
Put something in. Yeah.
Mm.
And yet we're kind of just expecting it to work. But the idea of prioritizing it is something that you talk about, which makes a lot of sense. Like, I think as a couple who have been together for quite a long time, we have, and you know, I've got three children, I've got the business, so there's quite a lot going on. And for mm-hmm. me, we've kind of worked out that when we step away from that, and whether that's a night away or whatever, and hand over to the grandparents, we connect immediately, and it's really good, and we feel really good. And yes, we'll probably have sex and all those things. And that's quite reassuring as well, because we go, we are okay. It's just life that makes it really
life.
Hard.
Yeah, and that's a great thing to realise, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's not realistic to go, oh, we'll just go away all the time. It's very nice. But I think that's really important, because I know, I think people maybe feel like they shouldn't do that because, again, well, it should just work. We should be able to make this work. So they don't prioritise each other. So they don't go away, or they don't try and get the kids off. I mean, even babysitting, you know, getting someone babysitting for the day. You don't have to have sex in the evening. It could be in the day.
It's actually sometimes the worst time,
especially
if you go out on a date and the pressure and you feel full. It doesn't work, does it? I guess, you know, it's one of the things that I try and do in the How to Not Let Kids Ruin Your Sex Life workshop is get people to really think about what function does sex serve in their relationship for them and for their partners, and really understand that about each other. Mm. Because often there are kind of key psychological needs or key relational needs, like for us as a couple, that sex meets for us. And we all have different ones. And we have this idea that it's just about horniness. And actually it sometimes is, but often people want sex for different reasons. It meets different needs for them, like feeling connected, like feeling alive, like not feeling like a mother.
Yes.
Like feeling like a strong couple, like having fun, you know, like trying to get pregnant, whatever it might be. There are different reasons we might be motivated to have sex. And it can be really great to understand that about each other, because you actually don't need to be having a lot of sex to meet those needs. Mm. So, you know, you're mentioning earlier about how we can often fall into the habit of, you know, kind of peck on the cheek or shouting goodbye at each other.
Yeah.
A simple change, like turning a peck on the cheek into a, actually, we're going to have like a 6-second full-on kiss before we say goodbye in the morning,
yeah,
can really change how you see each other sexually. It can really give you that spring in your step when you go to work or whatever. It can make you feel desired. It can make you feel sexually connected. It can make you feel like a strong couple. A lot of the things that we want to get from sex for us and our relationship, we can actually get in other ways, mm, even when we don't have time to have sex, or even when we've got a new baby and sex is like the last thing on our mind. So what I like to try and do with people is help them understand that for themselves and their partner and their relationship, and then try and find other ways to meet those needs as well as sex, because I think that's a kind of skill we all kind of need, as well as building sexual currency. It's about being able to feel our sex lives between us, even when we're not having sex.
Yeah. Well, and also that's the key bit about the sexual currency that you talk about, that it's not always a precursor to sex. You need to have this conversation, don't you?
Yeah.
You can't just start, because if you just start doing a bit more bum groping, and it probably that is like a precursor to then we're going to have sex.
Yeah, it looks like an initiation.
Yes.
And that's not what we want.
No.
We want it to be a standalone.
God, I'm too tired.
A standalone bit. And actually, you know, what happens when I get people to kind of ban sex, any type of sex, for a while, and just turn their sexual currency right up, mm-hmm, I get them to say, you know, frequent points in the day, send that text. I mean, it depends where people are starting from. Mm-hmm. If it's not comfortable, obviously we do that later on, but if people are comfortable to bring back passionate kissing, to be naked together, to send that text, do that bum grab, to give them that look, to say they look hot, all of those things that are sexual currency. Mm. When people dial that up, they start to see how easy that is a scaffold to kind of move to more, right, when wanted, but actually how much that triggers their desire. Because that passionate kiss without pressure, it needs to go anywhere, it does often trigger desire, in the, you know, as long as your brain's not full of other things, as long as it's the right time. But because we're reducing all of that sexual currency, because it's only part of initiating sex, and then sometimes we're putting a stop to it,
yeah,
we don't have any triggers for our desire.
Yeah. And the other thing, I guess, and I don't know how much you see this in your clinic, but the noise of, as well as you've got your mental load and all that stuff, but the noise and distraction of phones and smartphones, and you've mentioned eye contact, like sometimes one of us will come in from wherever, we haven't seen each other all day, and we're on our phone, and you kind of barely look up, and we've started to go, hang on, you haven't actually looked at me, you know, you have to almost call it out. But it was fun. I recorded a conversation with my parents about sex, because I wanted to put some bits into this, and then I've somehow.
Oh my god, that's brilliant!
Oh my god, I need to try and find it. I think I've bloody deleted it, but there was this bit. Oh, it was one of the best things I've ever done. It was so interesting, and we had a gin and tonic to do it, because it was a bit like, oh god, you know, my parents are in their 70s, and we've never talked about sex, but really interesting, because one of the things they were saying, I was like, you know, when you had small kids, did you ever have sex? You know, because personally, yeah, it's not something that was something I wanted to do when I had small kids. And they were like, Dad was like, well, you know, there were only 4 TV channels back then. And, and he said, you know, if there was nothing on that, we'd be like, we might go to bed early, and that might sometimes lead to sex. And we were giggling about it, but I was thinking, of course, like there was so much less to do.
Life was slower.
Yeah, but and that kind of made me think about how much, you know, switching off your phone, not looking for another box set to watch, because the amount of sex people are having must have been impacted by the amount of box sets people, or, you know, not I said box set, like I'm an old lady, but, you know, like series and stuff that people are watching.
Yeah. And, you know, we do know from sex research that the amount that we're having sex, certainly in Western societies, but probably worldwide, is going down each decade. So we do know that there's a gradual decrease in the frequency of sex lives of people in the UK, for example. And that's the main hypothesis, that it's the kind of constant distraction.
Yeah.
And What's interesting when you think about things like smartphone usage, and we're all guilty of it, aren't we? We all, you know, sit and scroll instead of sit and talk or whatever, is that it's not just the distraction of the phone taking you away from your partner onto the screen. So the lack of eye contact, the focus onto the phone rather than them, and the break in intimacy or connection that that brings. But it's also the psychological impact of your scrolling on where your attention is at as well. So, you know, we talked earlier about your brain, your thinking brain is always trying to push away the sexual kind of urges because it's got other things it wants to worry about or think about. So if you've got lots of priorities or lots of worries, it stops your body from sexually responding in the way you might like. So if you're scrolling and you see an email from your boss going, where's that report for tomorrow? You know, your anxiety then goes through the roof. Or if you're scrolling and you see someone on social media that you think, oh, they're living a better life than me, and
they look
actually
great,
feel a bit, I feel a bit crap. Yeah. Or if you're looking at images of people's bodies and then comparing yourselves yourself unfavorably. So there's like a two-step process where it takes you away from your partner, yes, but also it has a psychological impact on you. So there are a couple of things that I think are good. You know, we talked about changing cultures earlier. Good practices to get into. And the Gottmans, who are these kind of like relationship therapy gurus, they have this concept of kind of rituals of connection, which basically means you change the culture of your relationship to have a short period every day where you really connect and find out how each other is, how was your day, look each other in the eye, you know, just a bit of physical contact, a handhold, might be a kiss before you leave for work. But it's a ritual of connection that kind of anchors you together and gives you that space to really feel listened to and heard. And it doesn't have to be long, you know, it can be just a 5 or 10 minutes on the sofa after the kids have finally gone to bed for the last time and no one's getting up, to really look each other in the eye. No TV, no phones, just, you know, what was your day like today and what felt, what was great about it, but also what wasn't so great, and how are you really?
It's so easy to not do that. Like, I think that we find when we do have a weekend away or a night away or whatever, all this stuff comes out, and it'll be really trivial stuff. It could be like, oh, this guy at the coffee shop said X, or there was this woman doing whatever. It's just stuff that you might even end up talking more to your mates about, or someone you see on the school run regularly, because or work colleagues, people you talk to all the time. But you and your partner don't manage to have those conversations unless, like exactly as you're saying, I guess, that you make that time. Something that we did, we used to go to bed as soon as we got the kids down. Because I guess one benefit of small kids, unless you're having a nightmare with them, they do tend to go to bed by 7:30. We've now got an 11-year-old who kind of eats into the whole evening. So God knows when we're supposed to have sex. But
that is a challenge.
We would get the kids down, and then we would take a bottle of like Prosecco to bed. So it was that prioritizing each other and making a real effort. And I'm not saying I have to get drunk to be with my husband. But if you don't have a problem with booze, and if having a glass of something relaxes you, and maybe some of your inhibitions or your anxiety or whatever, just that relaxing, that would always be a really nice way to reconnect. And probably we would end up having sex. But it was just going into our space in our room and making it about us, not the kids there. And
absolutely. If you can make a ritual of connection like that, even if it's once a fortnight, once a month, if you want to do it every day, you can. But generally speaking, people have got stuff to do. But life to live. But if you can make a time where you go, you know, tonight, once the kids are in bed, let's go to bed, be together, talk about our day with no pressure for that to go anywhere. I can guarantee if there's going to be a time where desire is triggered, it will be then. So making that time without any sense of this is about sex, but actually it's about emotional connection. Yeah. It's about, if you can do it in bed, it's great, because you've also got the physical touch, and physical touch really is a stimuli for us. Like being naked with someone, physical touch really triggers desire. So making as many situations like that that are low pressure when we're not really tired, so when the kids are gone to bed, is great, is a really good idea. And if I could get more people to do that, and more people to be to passionately kiss, and more people to understand desire, I can guarantee we'd be having much greater sex as a nation than we are.
And the whole scheduling thing, because again, that's something that I think I used to think, we would have that conversation, but oh, that's really sad if we have to go right on Saturday at when the kids are smaller again, like at 1:30, they'll all be napping and da da da. But you kind of say that that's okay, that's perfectly okay.
So I am totally in for scheduling, mm-hmm. but not in for scheduling sex.
Okay.
So scheduling sex tends to be the pressure that comes with that sometimes switches off desire. So like a weekend away can feel quite pressurizing for some people. Mm-hmm. But scheduling time where desire might be triggered is an absolute must. And if people aren't on board with this, what they should do is map out their week and their partner's week and have a look where the crossover is, where they've actually got time, mm-hmm. where they'll be undisturbed and they're not asleep. And they'll find there's probably very little of the week where they actually have time together undisturbed. Mm. So expecting to both spontaneously feel like sex when you're probably also experiencing lower spontaneous desire at the same time, when you have very little time together anyway, undisturbed, it's impossible.
Yeah.
So if you don't find ways to schedule kind of prioritizing your sex life in whatever way that looks to see where the desire can be triggered, then actually you're just waiting to both feel like it at a magical time when there's no kids around and you're not tired.
Mm, which is
very, very unusual.
Very unlikely to happen.
Yeah. So big fan of scheduling, and scheduling, it has to be something which all parties are signed up to as not about scheduling sex, but let's just schedule all the sexual currency stuff, you know. Let's schedule like a massage, kissing, no pressure, being naked together and talking about our day, having the Prosecco in bed, whatever it might be, but not necessarily sex.
And you've talked about how we don't talk about sex enough, and we definitely didn't as kids. Like, it was sex education was about not getting pregnant, not catching STIs. It definitely wasn't about pleasure or relationships.
Right.
And again, it's really interesting. I think you were talking, it might have been on Sophie Ellis-Bextor's podcast, and you were talking about talking to your kids about porn. And off the back of that, I had a conversation with my 11-year-old. And I said to him, can I, it was like an evening, we were in the kitchen, it was just me and him, and I said, can I just talk to you a little bit about sex and porn? And his face was brilliant. he sort of lowered his head and was like, we have to. And I was like, no, I promised you, I'm not going to embarrass you. And it was, what was really useful is to use you as a way of saying it. So it wasn't just me
reading
it. I was like, I've been reading this book because I'm interviewing this person and saying, like, she says it's really important to talk to kids about porn. And he hasn't got a smartphone. I know a couple of his friends have seen stuff. I don't know what he's seen. But I just basically said exactly as you said, which was that they're acting, that that isn't what necessarily looks like. Sex is supposed to be enjoyable. Just a few things. I didn't labour the point. And he was like, okay. And I said, the thing is, Buster, and we ended up having a conversation about mental health. Because I said, when we were kids, none of this stuff seemed to be talked about. Whereas we're much more aware of psychology and mental. I mean, I would have had no idea at 11 what psychology and mental health was.
Yes.
And he totally knew what I was talking about. And I just thought it was so interesting because actually he was quite receptive and I wouldn't have had that conversation if I'd not heard you. And then I was talking to Doug about it and we were like, I think it's little and often just making sure we keep that conversation open so he can ask us. But it was so useful to have you as that expert, because otherwise it's just your mum talking to you about sex. No one wants that.
I love that. Feel free to use me whenever it's helpful.
I will.
the key thing here is, you know, we're not raised to talk about sex comfortably, and therefore talking about sex is hard.
Yeah.
And do we want to replicate that for our own kids? Probably not, because not being able to talk about sex is connected with lower sexual satisfaction. Kids that don't feel kind of well prepared for sex because they don't have great sex education tend to be kids that have sex earlier than they want to, tend to be the kids that are more at risk of outcomes that they don't want, like unexpected pregnancies, tend to have sex more out of peer pressure than when they feel ready. So the evidence is strong that good sex education, which of course means talking to kids about sex, is good. But for us, it's not comfortable because we've not been raised knowing how to do it. So we might have the best intentions because we know it's good. And the question is, how do we go about it? The key thing is, you don't have to be great at it to get the most important message across. And the most important message you can get across is, you can talk to me about this stuff and I will not be cross. That if there's one message you need to get across, it's that. Nothing else really matters, because if you're a bit awkward about it, you can just say, oh, you know, I'm not, no one ever talked to me about it. Yeah. So this is something it's okay for us to talk about. I will never be cross. And, you know, porn is just one aspect of good sex ed. But I think with porn, it is really important to get that message across, because it's so common for kids to have seen porn by kind of the early secondary school years on other people's phones, or hear people talking about it as well. It's just so important to get that message across, that you may well see this, you might be curious and find it, you might stumble across it searching for something else, someone might tell you about it. I will never be angry that you've seen it. Come and talk to me about it. We can talk about what's real, what's not, how it made you feel. It's always okay. And that's the most important message, really.
Yeah.
So it's all right if it's awkward.
Yeah. And even just to say, like, bodies, the bodies you see in porn. And I think I said something about big willies and, you know, and hair and all that stuff. Like, and as a kid, if you're seeing that, it's just a lot, isn't it? It's a lot to take on. And then if that's your only introduction to bodies and sex, like, and no wonder everyone's a bit screwy, really.
There's lots of free porn around that is very problematic and misogynistic, and we shouldn't overlook that. But it's important to note that porn is actually not the enemy.
Poor
sex ed is the enemy.
Yeah.
And without good sex ed, that's free porn is all kids have to learn from.
Yeah.
So a bit like the culture of our sex lives is something that it's good to kind of nurture little and often, I would say conversations with sex about kids are also good things to nurture little and often. So, you know, getting good age-appropriate books for them, recommending like good websites for them to look at that are around their age range if they're kind of mid to late teens. But just not shying away from conversations about sex in the house, like not giving an impression that sex is a dirty word or something. You know, just yesterday, in fact, my five-year-old was saying something about that the nine-year-old has a book that's by Corey Silverberg called Sex Is Not a Funny Word.
Okay.
And it's a really good book. And my five-year-old was going, I want to read that as my bedtime story. And I said, well, you can, but it's a little bit old for you. So maybe wait till you're a bit older. And the older one was enjoying being the older one. I was like, yeah, you can't read that till you're at least eight.
Yeah.
Feeling really proud of himself.
Yeah.
And the little one said, well, then it might explain what sex is to me. He said, it might tell me what sex is. And I said, well, I can tell you that.
Hey, hang on, this is my specialist subject.
I said, sex is just a fun thing that people do with their bodies. Mm. And when you're a grown up, you'll enjoy it as well.
Yeah.
And that's the end of it. It's a shame-free, sex is okay. Let's not shy away from it. It's that little and often.
But how powerful to be able to say to your kids, sex is meant to be enjoyable. Like, and how that was completely missing for lots of us, you know, for generations of kids.
And it's implicit when we turn the TV over, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, when we were younger, if that happened for us, it's implicit. This is shameful.
Yes.
You shouldn't be doing it. We can't speak of it. It's wrong. And look at all the negative things that can happen if you do this, especially for women.
Yeah. So you've got two boys and obviously a big career, and you're busy helping loads of people, and you're a wife, you've got all this stuff going on. So I suppose just before, because we're going to go on to some questions from people, but just on this idea of this rush hour and overwhelm, is it something that you feel like that overwhelm, and how do you feel if you feel that coming?
Oh gosh, I mean, all the time. It's part and parcel of all of those balls in the air, isn't it? Yeah, I mean, I do. I have that constant thing, which I'm sure we all feel, where you think, I'm not actually doing anything well enough.
Mm.
That's a very common feeling. I suppose I sometimes just kind of, every once in a while, I'll reevaluate the things I feel overwhelmed about. Or sometimes I try and have a bit of a sense check and think, which are the things that are most important, like, right now?
Mm-hmm.
Because I'll often get overwhelmed with all the different balls I'm juggling. You know, I have an NHS job as well as my private work, and I've got, you know, there's different competing priorities even in my work life. So I have to really think about I've got all of these things to do, but actually, will the world stop if I don't do them? And is it important that I get to that parents' reading breakfast tomorrow and have to accept that I might not feel like I'm doing anything well enough?
I
don't think there's a solution to it other than accepting it's something everyone feels.
And then do you try and then take some things out? Is that how you kind of handle it?
I think I try and delay them. I think I've got better kind of over the last kind of 20 years or so that I've been working. I think I've got a lot better at managing the peaks. Mm. When the peaks are coming. So, you know, I did another TED talk a couple of weeks ago and I've had a very short turnaround to it. And I knew when I took it on that it was going to be a peak and that everything else I would struggle to manage around it.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what it was. And I think I had to really say to myself, this is a peak and it will pass.
Yeah.
And actually leave that. And a couple of weeks will be okay. And probably, you know, a decade or so ago or more, I would have got quite stressed and thought, oh, but there's this thing and I'm not doing it and that thing. And I think I've got a bit better at delaying things that do feel important and saying, well, it is important, but it can probably wait.
Yeah. No, that's really
and managing that and, you know, knowing that I'm in one of those stressy peaks and saying to my partner, please, can you do this and that and take over this, which works really well for me.
Yeah. Well, are you okay to move on to a few questions that we've got?
Yeah, let's do it.
The questions I've got, they were all from women. This lady said, I don't fancy him anymore. He's let himself go and makes no effort and it bothers me as I feel like I have to uphold some kind of standard and I can't just wear tracky bottoms and grow all my hair. Do I tell him and how?
I love this question. This is a really juicy question and I want us to unpack it a little bit. But physical attraction is important. And we know that it's important at the start of a relationship. And the more physically attractive we are to someone at the start, often the easier it is to maintain over time. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important not to dismiss the importance of physical attraction to another person. It does sometimes go away and we don't get it back. Mm-hmm. And I know that's probably not something people want to hear, but the reality is, in a monogamous relationship, sometimes people's feelings for someone change and they stop being attracted to them. And when that happens, it can be really difficult to maintain an interest sexually because our sexual desire is often based on a kind of premise of finding someone attractive. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So I guess I just want to put that out there, that it's an uncomfortable truth that sometimes our attraction to people does change. But for this person, it sounds like their attraction is mediated by their partner's kind of presentation of themselves and that actually they have a strong sense that if their partner were to do things differently slightly, that actually they may feel more attracted. Mm-hmm. And that's why they're wondering about saying something. So I feel it's quite important in our sex lives to always be able to be upfront about the things that we might want and need to keep our sex lives good, because it's not just benefiting us, it's benefiting both of us and it's benefiting the relationship. So honesty is always good. But there are certain things which are a bit harder to talk about and it might be worth couching them in a wider conversation about our relationship and a wider conversation about desire. So I wouldn't advocate saying you've let yourself go and I don't find you attractive anymore.
And also if a woman said that, or a woman or man said that to a woman, I would probably be more defensive of her, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I agree. And I also wouldn't advocate for not saying that. And I would say that the other way around as well. So, you know, what we're just saying, if that was a man saying that to a woman, it's also not helpful to not say that. It might be hard to have these conversations, but actually it is quite important, because what are we both there for? Are we both there in this relationship for the long haul? And if we are, then don't we want to know the things that our partner might find important? And it may be that that's not acceptable to us. It may be that our partner says, I always want you to be really made up. And I always want you to wear these clothes. And you might go, actually, that's not going to work for me. Off you go. Mm. That's your choice to make. But actually, if your partner finds certain things, or if this person finds certain things work to make her feel more attracted, then doesn't he want to know that? I suspect he probably will. So it's about how to couch it in language that's comfortable. So one of the things she might want to do is, I have a free download which is accessible on my Insta through the link in my bio, which is called Conditions for Good Sex. It's in the book as well.
Yeah.
It's a triangle.
Yeah.
I would say, I was listening to this podcast. It was all about like things that are important in our sex life and things that will keep our sex life good. Let's do this thing separately, then come together to discuss it. Mm-hmm. And in the Conditions for Good Sex triangle, she might write something like, I feel really psychologically attracted to you when you're dressed smartly, when you blah, 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 you know, yeah, whatever it yeah. is for her that matters. And when she expresses that to him, she can say, you know, obviously you're not going to dress like this all the time, but I'd love it if we could like build this in a little bit more. Mm. And it's not just that one thing, it's other things that she's got down as well. But you can throw that in there as well and say, this is actually quite important to me. It's quite a political issue, this, and it comes up a lot in sex therapy, where people say to me, my partner like used to work out more than they currently do.
Right.
And I don't currently find their body as attractive as I did before.
It's so loaded, isn't it? It's really hard.
It's so loaded, but also like we are also human beings. And yes, we've been socialized to find certain bodies attractive. Mm-hmm. But we still find certain things more attractive than others. And that's not something we can easily change. Mm. And so a very kind of considered, careful conversation might be important there. Yeah. And it's very difficult to manage, but I do think it can be done. And sometimes honesty is important, as long as it's very considerate and thought through.
Well, and I suppose in most cases, if someone has a low libido and if they're thinking that they're the problem, then to read your book's really reassuring. For the other person to read the book is also really reassuring.
And also I would add in, there's another thing here that's sometimes about how someone looks after themselves. It's sometimes more than the aesthetic. It's sometimes a sense that they're actually not, in inverted commas I'm doing here, like letting themselves go.
Yeah.
And that is about how much they're prioritizing you.
Yeah.
So sometimes people will say they've let themselves go and they only wear these things. But it's not that it's those things they're wearing or the fact they've put on a bit of weight or whatever it might be. It's not that. It's the fact they feel they're not making an effort for them anymore and what that signifies.
Yeah. Doug has this thing where his hair tips over. It reaches a point where it just looks a bit like an old lady's hair. And it really bothers me. And I'll be like, you need to get a haircut. And I get so affronted by it. And he's like, why do you care? But I think that that probably is what's going on. I'm like, well, why do you get away with not having to make an effort? I don't know.
Yeah.
But it feels weird to say it, I suppose.
And there are different standards, aren't there, for people of different genders around how much you're supposed to make an effort with your appearance. And women are held to these really unreasonable standards around all these types of things. And sometimes it can feel really frustrating if you think someone else is getting away scot-free.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
All they want you to do is this. Do it.
Yeah. Okay, so this next one, I've had a baby, my body feels alien and a bit gross, I'm tired and a bit sad, and we're both freaking out that we haven't had sex in 7 months, but it's just awkward now, so we avoid talking about it. I've no idea how to get it back and I'm scared this is going to end us.
I mean, I would be really keenly suggesting that they don't worry about sex right now, but they absolutely must talk about it. Mm. I want them to talk about what it is that they miss when they're not having sex. Both of them, because she's probably missing how she felt before as well.
Yeah.
How are the ways that they could try and nurture that in the meantime? How can they kind of really, really connect in terms of emotional intimacy so they feel strong as a couple despite not having sex for a while? And the relationship will survive a time without sex as long as the two of you feel like a team.
Mm. Okay, I'm just having a look at which one I want to go for next. Okay, when we have sex, it's always good, but getting there is an issue. I've no interest, and if I think he's giving me a look, I actively avoid it, which I know makes him feel rejected. I seem to only remember the good bits of sex just after doing it. How do I improve my sex drive? So this is one we've talked about previously.
Yeah, it's basically that our whole conversation has been for this person.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Low levels of spontaneous desire.
Yeah.
Responsive desire kicks in really easily when they're getting there, but they've reduced sexual currency because they're worried about it meaning initiation and not something else.
Yeah.
So very little triggers to desire. Afterwards, they're like, that was really good. Why don't we do it more often?
Yeah.
So this is a classic case of understand how desire works, increase sexual currency, make sure there's no pressure for that currency to lead anywhere, know that desire needs to be triggered, find times where you can schedule to allow it to be nurtured if you want it to, and know that you're not broken.
Okay, I've just got one last one about a cheating partner. Again, I think I've seen this play out for people and it's a really difficult one. So the person said, my partner cheated and I want to make it work, but I just can't do the sex bit. The rest of the time we're fine and can ignore what happened. But as soon as there's even a hint of anything intimate, I pull away and get cross and ruin any moment that could be interpreted as a precursor to sex.
Common one. I suppose what we don't know, and I'd need to know for this person, is what is it that gets in the way? So it might be that it's feelings of anger and resentment and not wanting to be sexually intimate with them because of those feelings, and those things still need processing. And I don't know how much talking they've done. I don't know whether they've had any couples therapy. I don't know what they've done to try and think about the infidelity and the impact it's had on them, but they may need to do some more of that. I guess it's also possible that it's thoughts of them with the other person that are coming into their mind. Without knowing exactly what it is that's going on for them, it's hard to answer that one. But I would say, I would recommend here that this person reads, if they've not read it already, The State of Affairs by Esther Perel. So Esther Perel's book about monogamy and infidelity is a really good book here around thinking about processing and understanding infidelity in relationships that were supposed to be monogamous, and that might really help them.
Yeah. That's awesome. I mean, thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you. It's been great to be here. I've enjoyed our chat.
Thank you so much to Karen. I hope you found that all as eye-opening and reassuring as I did. There are lots of resources and books that Karen mentions, as well as her TEDx talk on desire and another one that was released just recently on the power of orgasms to address gender equality. So the links to all of those things will be in the notes for this episode. And while you're there, that's where you can rate and review us and also subscribe. Obviously, if this has made you think differently about sex or your sex life, get in touch. Get in touch on Insta or email podcast@don'tbuyherflowers.com. I want to say nothing would make me happy to know people are having great sex because of this podcast, but is that weird? No, I think that's okay. sharing is caring. Anyway, also massive thanks to Love Honey for sponsoring this episode. Next week, we have our first man on the podcast, Matthew Frey, talking about how his marriage ended, and there are some amazing insights on relationships. It's another big one that personally has led to quite a big impact on Doug and I, and the conversations we're having and how we're trying to make our relationship work. So until then, I hope you have an excellent week.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.